Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This 13th day of February, 2019. We're ready for arguments in the first case, which is Landmark Community Bank versus John Klingenhutz et al. Respondents. Would each of the attorneys be sure to introduce himself for the record immediately before beginning argument? And with that, we'll hear from counsel for appellant, please.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Steck, and I represent the appellant Landmark Community Bank. This case presents essentially three questions. The first, did the district court abuse its discretion by rejecting the assessed value of the property on the basis that an assessed value is not the same as a market value? Second, did the district court misapply the law in granting an agricultural exemption, a higher agricultural exemption to the property? And third, did the district court err by relying on a published authority of this court in a case involving the same defendant and the same arguments to rule that the guarantee mortgage only becomes an actual liability upon the actual making of a claim? With regard to the first question, did the district court abuse its discretion by rejecting the assessed value on the basis of a dichotomy between an assessed value and a market value? It's clear that the district court made a mistake in this area. As Minnesota statutes make clear with regard to assessments, all assessments are based on market value. There is no dichotomy between an assessed value and a market value. They're the same thing. An assessment is a determination of what the fair market value of a property is so that the taxes can be based upon that fair market value. But the respondents in the district court essentially shift the burden here. They say that, well, yes, there was this tax assessment for $2.4 million, but you need to prove that that's right. They're telling this that the appellant has to prove that that is a correct value. Otherwise, we stick with this universally admitted to be flawed appraisal value for the property of about $1.9 million.
Counsel, what's your authority for the proposition that the assessed value is the same as market value?
The statute cited on page 17 of our primary brief, that being the statutes for the instructing the assessors how to assess the value of a property. It says that it's to be based on the market value. It says the same thing. There's also a case referenced on that page that states holds the same thing. Assessed value and market value are the same thing.
The reason that gives me pause is because in addressing the second argument regarding the exemption, I've been reading a lot of property tax classification statutes, and by the time you wade through all this, it seems like it's much more complicated. Like there's a lot of exceptions for different things, for different uses, for different parcels, and I wonder if one can necessarily just say, well, tax assessed value is the same as market value. Maybe that's the goal, but I wonder if that's the reality.
For the basic definition of the terms, yes, it is the same. Now, for the purposes of specific programs like the Green Acres, the legislature might set out an additional consideration or sort of saying, when we're talking about taxes, we want you to depart from the assessed value in a particular way, such as the Green Acres program, which has a particular reason for doing that.
Why do people do assessments for valuation trials if assessed value is the same as market value?
You mean why people do appraisals?
Right.
Because essentially they're trying to say that they're trying to present evidence that the assessed value might be, or perhaps be wrong. But that does then acknowledge the burden of proof is on the party challenging the assessed value. The assessed value essentially sets a baseline, something that we say this is what the property is worth unless you get an appraisal that you can prove is better.
Well, isn't that, counsel, isn't that the whole point here? I mean, assessed value is challenged all the time in court and condemnation cases and other cases. It's a snapshot of one tax assessor's belief as to the value of the land. But in this case, we had one appraisal and one expert testify. We didn't have anybody else. You seem to be suggesting that it was unfair that your client couldn't just rest on the tax assessed value. Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that the appraisal then has to be shown to be superior. And everybody, the district court, the respondents, and the appellants, all agree that the appraisal is extremely unreliable. I mean, the district court originally found in its original order that the appraisal had undervalued the property by about $10,000 per acre. That's a big bite. And in its subsequent order, when it ultimately winds up relying on the appraisal, the district court mysteriously found that it had undervalued the property by about $15,000 per acre. So it actually said, you made an even bigger error on this appraisal that I've already found to be unreliable, but I'm going to rely on it. That doesn't make any sense.
What is your response to the argument that these tax assessed values were submitted after the close of evidence, and you were asking the court to take judicial notice of them at that time?
The court acknowledged that in its original order, that particular problem, and it gave the respondents an explicit opportunity to respond to that. In other words, if the respondents wanted to present evidence on how these assessed values were incorrect, they had the opportunity to do that.
And they some didn't. Type of written submission?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And they didn't do that. Instead, they submitted an affidavit about how the appraisal is okay. But they did not present any evidence, even at the district court's specific invitation, that the assessed value was wrong. So they said, well, we acknowledge that you've given us this invitation to question the assessed values, but we're going to respond with something else.
But doesn't presenting an appraisal suggest that the assessed values are wrong? I mean, how else would they have, what evidence would they have presented to show that the assessed values were wrong, if not for an appraisal contradicting the assessed values?
But the appraisal was already in the record. They weren't comparing the appraisal to the assessed value in their additional presentations. They were merely trying to say, hey, this appraisal isn't as bad as you thought it was. The district court didn't accept that argument. It said that actually the appraisal was still unreliable, and it was even more unreliable than previously thought.
At the end of the day, the district court had the tax assessed value for 2012, because it said it wasn't considering other years, they weren't relevant, and the appraisal, and it chose between them. How do we say the district court was wrong in making the choice to go with the appraisal, even though it was flawed? Are you saying, well, absent some evidence, you know, specifically showing that this tax assessed value was wrong, it's binding on a district court?
The reason that the district court erred was because the reasoning that it gave for rejecting that assessed value was the statement of, well, this is the assessed value, but an assessed value is not the same as market value. That's the reasoning the district court used. That reasoning is just flat wrong. So the error comes in relying on a line of reasoning to reject the assessment that is just flat wrong as a legal matter. It is not the fact that an appraisal is different from a market value. Now, with regard to the second question, did the district court misapply the law in granting an agricultural exception? Now, there's been a lot of discussion in the briefing about the applicability of the Barron case, and I think that is exactly where the court should focus. Because the Barron case, the respondents are correct, the Barron case was abrogated by statute. It's a case about what does primarily used mean in the context of the Green Acres program. The fact that it was abrogated and the way it was abrogated by statute is exactly the reason why it's instructive here. It was changed, the statute was changed for the Green Acres program to change the term primarily used for agricultural purposes to just plain being used for agricultural purposes, to remove the word primarily. So now more properties that weren't that had some agricultural use but weren't primarily for agricultural use could be eligible for the Green Acres program.
What's the current language, the amended language?
That it has to be used for agricultural purposes.
What statute are you citing?
273.13 subdivision 23 paragraph E.
Okay, that's the classification statute.
Correct, the tax classification statute.
That's how you get the class taxification. Isn't the Green Acres deferment program set forth in 273.111?
I could be incorrect in calling it the Green Acres statute.
I don't know why anyone's calling it that, because I don't see that language in the statute, but the statute that was cited and that seems to reflect the district court's reasoning is section 273.111. which is a section describing a delayed form of taxation for agricultural property taxes. And that statute says in subdivision 3 that a property qualifies for that treatment, for tax deferment, if it is primarily devoted to agricultural use. So it seems we have on one hand a statute that says to get an agricultural classification, it just needs to be use with no modifier of the amount of use, but to get into this tax deferment program, which is what defendants were claiming, the property has to be primarily devoted to agricultural use, which sounds a lot like used primarily for agricultural purposes, which is the standard for the exemption.
No. To the extent that any whichever statute applies, relies on the requirement that it be primarily used. Barron is instructive as to what that means. So perhaps I'm referring to the wrong statute, but I'm referring to the right case. And the case, Barron describes what primarily used means, and it's clear that it doesn't apply here. Where the value of where the agricultural use of the property is minimal, as in this case, $4,000 a year and some feed for hobby horses, it does not qualify as primarily used under Barron.
What's the definition of primarily used under Barron?
Mainly or chiefly is what it means. So can it be said that something which has an agricultural value of about $4,000 per year against the $2.4 million or even a $1.9 million property, can it be said that the primary use or the main or chief use of that property is for agriculture? No, it simply cannot, and it flies directly in the face of Barron to say that.
So your argument would be, regardless of the tax classification or participation in the tax deferment for agricultural property, the record shows that this wasn't used primarily for agricultural purposes.
Correct, because what we're talking about here is not whatever its tax classification purpose is. Although it may be using similar language, that's a different statute. We're looking at 510-102, and that is, does it get a homestead exemption? So is it primarily used? Mm-hmm. We look to Barron for instruction on what primarily used means, since we don't have anything specific to 510-02 that tells us what primarily used means. We assume that they mean the same thing in different places unless we have a reason not to. Now, it's clear that it doesn't apply, given the principles laid out in Barron, or the definition for how we look at the term primarily used for agricultural purposes. The last matter that I'd like to address is the question raised in the related appeal. Did the district court err by relying on published authority of this court? And I'd note that the previous case involved the exact same defendant, Mr. Klingelhutz, and the exact same argument, the argument that this guarantee mortgage counts as a liability against the property, regardless of whether or not an actual claim of default is made. And Klingelhutz clearly ruled on this. The first Klingelhutz case clearly ruled on this question. Now, the respondents are asking this court to say, yeah, we were wrong. So we're going to reverse ourselves and go back on that.
No. We have done that. I mean, you talk about stare decisis and other, you know, principles, but we occasionally find that our prior decisions are erroneous.
And I'd note that when the court does that, it's usually almost always in the case of an unpublished decision, not a published decision. Published decisions are different from unpublished decisions because they're circulated throughout the court rather than just to the panel. So there's much less justification or room for seeing how a prior error could be made with a published decision than with an unpublished decision. But also, this has already been litigated, and there was a petition for review to the Supreme Court. So if the respondent's argument was correct, that this court just flat got wrong about what Schmidt says in Klingelhutz 1, then I don't know. Is the respondent's argument that the Supreme Court just missed it? I would expect that their petition for review raised this point, and the Supreme Court did not pass on it. So I don't see where this court has any justification to say, yeah, you're right. 1 year ago, we were flat wrong on a decision that was published, so we're just going to reverse it. And play this out. What happens then if that becomes the case? Does Landmark get to come back in a year and say, you know what? You messed up on Schmidt last time, so we want to do it again. We can go round and round on this forever. That's the whole point. When this court issues a published decision, the district courts are supposed to be able to rely on it, and the litigants are supposed to be able to rely on it. And that's particularly notable in the case of property, where people are having to rely on this with regards to real property. Now, the reason that Klingelhutz 1 is correct in its reading of Schmidt is exactly what the issue is here. What happens if these guarantee mortgages, absent an actual claim of default, can become a liability against the property? Well, they become an easiest tool in the world to avoid debtors. All you do is slap a guarantee mortgage on everything, establish an event of default that can be triggered by anything, and then say, can't get my property, it's out of reach. And that's exactly what this court said in Klingelhutz 1, was the danger in allowing that sort of thing to happen, is that it simply comes an easy way to, on paper, shield all property from debtors, or from creditors. That's the reason why, even if this court might have some doubt about whether or not this court read Schmidt right. The policy reason articulated in Klingelhutz 1 as to why the guarantee mortgages can't be used this way remains valid. And that is essentially you're making it impossible to collect on a debt at that point if somebody's clever enough to know about the guarantee mortgages trick. Mr. Klingelhutz tried that in the first case. This court rejected it. He's here trying it again. We're asking this court not to do that and to deny the related appeal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Rod Crass, and I'm representing John and Doreen Klingelhutz in this matter. And before I get into my actual argument, I'd like to respond to a couple of issues brought up by questions you've raised. One question dealt with the final issue, the associated appeal of ours, and whether the Supreme Court was aware when the petition was filed for a review of the first case, the first landmark case, whether the Supreme Court was appraised of the issue we have now raised. And I'm sorry to tell you that the attorneys who handled that did not raise that issue at that point, were unaware that Schmidt had been miscited in the landmark case.
I'm a little confused by the argument that Schmidt was miscited, because I read Schmidt, and it seems like we cited Schmidt for sort of a general definition of what a guarantee is, as opposed to relying on Schmidt, the facts of that case, the procedural posture of that case, or the ruling of that case. We just simply put a cite with a sort of general definition of how a guarantee works.
The problem with the landmark case is this holding, and I'm reading from it. A guarantee is a conditional obligation that does not become absolute until a default in the underlying obligation.
And But Schmidt doesn't say that.
Schmidt does not say that, yet your court claims it did.
Well, our court claims that Schmidt defined what a guarantee is. I think your quarrel is with the holding of this court. I don't think...
I'm not inclined
to reverse landmark because you think we miscited Schmidt. I mean, it goes to the heart of the matter. Did we misconstrue what a guarantee mortgage is such that we didn't.
And that misconstruing, deficit. I'm suggesting, came from the citation of this court to Schmidt making that claim, whereas Schmidt,
So what you're saying is we didn't come up with that on our own. We think Schmidt compelled that conclusion, and Schmidt doesn't compel that conclusion because
yes.
The facts of Schmidt had nothing to do with the facts of landmark.
As a matter of fact, Schmidt says the opposite. It says, and I quote, the guarantor's liability arose as and when he became a guarantor. That's what Schmidt actually says, and that's completely inconsistent with the first landmark holding. And that's the issue that we're bringing up in that regard.
But the first landmark holding also gave some sort of policy reasons for why the court ruled as it did, which would have nothing to do with Schmidt or reliance on Schmidt. It seems that there were other concerns underlying that decision.
But, Your Honor, the reliance of our trial court was on the portion of landmark that I just cited. And that's the reason we lost in the trial court on that issue is because of this contention of landmark.
Understood.
As you're aware, the property here was a 50-acre agricultural homestead, which...
Counsel, because your time is limited, and I think we're all aware of the facts, could we talk for a moment about this market value issue? One thing that's odd to me is that the district court doesn't seem to have really determine the value of the property. I mean, the district court's finding is the reasonable value of the property as of February 29th, 2012 was not less than $1,935,000. Is
the
that
appraisal.
An adequate?
Yeah. That's the appraisal amount.
That is the appraisal amount, but the district court didn't say this is the value of the property. The district court said, well, the property's worth at least this amount.
And that's
Doesn't
the amount.
Doesn't that leave sort of an unanswered question as to what the property is actually worth? Given the way the district court framed this finding?
Your Honor, I would suggest when you read the findings and conclusions together, it does come to that absolute conclusion because that's the number
that
he used in
used.
The analysis. And that analysis has to start with the market value of the property. And as a result, that's what he concluded. He initially.
But also in the conclusion, the district court again writes the property value is not less than $1,935,000. That leaves a question in my mind of do we really know what the property value is? I mean, the district court said it's at least this, so this is the number I'm using, but the district court's findings and conclusion indicates it could be higher. Well, if it could be higher, the outcome of this case could change. So I mean, isn't that a
two things.
Bit
number
of a concern?
One, he used that number in the conclusions in as the value. And so I think you need reading all of it together to recognize that was his decision. Secondly, that wouldn't change the outcome. This property was so underwater, $550,000 in the minus category.
Assuming that the accurate exemption was applied.
Correct. That either one of these two claims on appeal does not put it in the positive. Both of them have to exist before this case gets reversed. So when we look at the first one of those that I'd like to talk about, and that's with the question of the agricultural homestead.
Counsel, on that topic, would you agree that the testimony was insufficient to establish agricultural use? Putting aside the tax classification, I'm just talking about testimony.
The testimony was very sparse about the use of the property, but both Klingel Huts testified about the growing of crops consistently on that property for all the time that they owned it. And I don't want to brush aside the issue of the determination of the assessor that this was agricultural homestead.
Well, I'm trying to separate the two because it seems to me that the testimony was inadequate to establish use, which places great significance on the tax classification. In other words, the Green Acres classification has to be accepted in order to find agricultural use.
There were two determinations made by the assessor. You just mentioned one, the Green Acres determination, which is under the primary use classification. And
that got in effect in 2000.
That right? went into effect in 2000. And don't forget that statute requires 7 years of the same use prior to the application before it can be accepted. So that goes back to 93.
And can we agree, section 273.111, that's the Green Acres?
It is.
Okay.
I think counsel misstated what he was looking at, because the second category where the assessor made a determination was in the category of determining what this property is. And don't forget, his determination by statute is prima facie evidence of it, and he's made this determination on two different separate occasions every year since at least 2000.
But the thing is, as I understand it, you correct me if I'm wrong, you make a classification of the land. The land's classified as agricultural land. But that classification doesn't require, it's not based on primary use, it's just based on any use.
It is, that is correct.
And then, but to get the Green Acre treatment, you need to show primary use.
Yes.
So it's not just the classification that gets you to the standard, it's the Green Acres designation. That's your argument.
That's our argument, that he's made two of these determinations.
Well, counsel, yes, but when it's classified agricultural, what they're really saying is it's not commercial or residential. It's just a broad classification. So now we move to the Green Acres, and now we're getting into primary use.
I'm sorry, Judge, that's not what the statute says. Agricultural use is, and I'll quote, means the raising, cultivation, drying, storage of agricultural products for sale or the storage of machinery or equipment used in that production. It is not some nebulous, broad classification.
But the point is that within the same section you just read from, it says agricultural land, as used in this section, means contiguous acreage of 10 acres or more used during the preceding year for agricultural purposes, period. It doesn't say how much use. As opposed to later, the statute says agricultural land also includes less than 10 acres if it's used exclusively in the preceding year for agricultural purposes.
It does.
So that would suggest that somebody could get an agricultural classification without regard to how much agricultural purposes, how much agricultural use there was. There just needs to be some. It doesn't have to be the primary use.
And it doesn't have to be primary. They changed this statute, taking away the word primary. They didn't like barrens. And this was a reaction to barrens.
But so when I look at these statutes, I can see why you would argue, well, if you've qualified for Green Acres treatment, that's relevant, because to get that treatment, somebody has to find that the property is primarily devoted to agricultural use, which is similar to the exemption standard.
Correct.
But I don't think that argument is as strong with regard to just having agricultural classification, because that classification doesn't seem to require any consideration of the amount of agricultural use. There just needs to be some.
But, Your Honor, that's what the legislature decided. We can't write words into this statute. This was a response to barrens, and they said, we're lessening the standard. Not only are we lessening the standard, we're precluding.
Right, but they lessened the standard for the purposes of tax classification. They didn't lessen the standard in 510.02. It still says use primarily.
That may be the case, but they indicated where they were going with this when they amended this statute in response to barren. And they also added that agricultural classification cannot be based on market value of residential structures, plural, on the property.
Which is what happened in barren, essentially.
Which is what happened in barren. But the more important part of barren, and the reason we think it supports our position, is the language the court used in barren, saying that the task of the assessor in classification involves fact-finding responsibility, and it's not simply an administrative calculation. Whether a piece of property qualifies for a particular classification clearly depends on a wide range of factual judgments concerning compliance with specified statutory criteria. They then go on to say,
Counsel, if we are to give that much deference to the tax assessor's determination regarding the classification of the property, why aren't we giving the same amount of deference to the tax assessor's determination of the value of the property?
Great case. Great question. And here's the answer. And as we've cited in our brief, the actual determinations of value made by the assessor are every 5 years. Every 5 years. We have no idea when the determination they're trying to use was actually made. And in that regard, the judge, in commenting on their request for taking judicial notice, said the plaintiffs did not provide the court with any support for the alleged assessed values. Didn't put it on us, put it on them.
So there's nothing in the record that tells us when the 2012 valuation was determined.
You are correct. It could have been
4 years old.
It could have been it's always a year behind, as you're aware. Mm-hmm. So it could have been January 2nd, 2011, all the way back to January 2nd, 2007. We have no idea when that occurred. And one of you asked a question about the question of actually using the tax valuations as asking the court and this court to take judicial notice. Clearly, it does not qualify for judicial notice because it is not agreed upon, and there is no place for this court or any court to go to find the actual market value based on a tax value determination because of the five-year issue. Even if in 2011 that was a new year and they did the valuation then, we're still 14 months away when this transfer occurred. That is why every appraisal you have ever seen notes the tax value, but doesn't ever rely on it. They go to the market as of the date of the transfer, and that's how appraisal work is done. That's why the court, even though it had issues with the appraisal, that's why the court accepted it, because it was the only thing it had. They cannot rely on a request for the court to take judicial notice, giving, as the court noted, no notice to us, which is contrary to the rule also, and no ability for us to comment on that request as it came in the simultaneous filings. So for those reasons, we're asking that you uphold the two decisions made respecting their appeal, and that you take an awfully hard look at whether or not you need to do something with the first case, the first landmark case, which is now binding with that holding on every trial court.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
I'd like to start at the end of the respondent's argument with this question about the assessed values and the fact that it might be 5 years old. I think the quotation from the district court is exactly the problem here, is that the district court said that the plaintiffs did not provide support for the assessed valuation. That's the shift of the burden that's not supposed to be happening here. Under MUFTA, the defendants bear the burden of proof, not the plaintiffs. The defendants have the burden of proof to show that the assessment was wrong. It's not that the plaintiffs have the burden of proof to show that it was right.
When was this assessment done?
It was a 2012 assessment. We don't know when it was done, when it was actually done.
Which paragraph are you referring to, Mr. Steck?
The one that was just quoted by the court. I don't have the order in front of me, but where it said that the plaintiffs did not provide support for the assessment. That's the problem. The plaintiffs don't have the burden of proof here. The defendants do, and they didn't do it.
Well, they went forward with their appraisal, didn't they?
They moved forward with the appraisal, but the district court gave them a specific opportunity to respond to the assessment. There's a specific provision in the order that says this, my taking into account the, I'm assuming that these representations that the plaintiffs have made about the 2012 and 2013 assessments are right, subject to the opportunity from the defendants to submit additional arguments on why that assessment might be wrong. They didn't submit any arguments as to why the assessment was wrong. They only submitted an affidavit with regard to the appraisal saying, hey, it's not as bad as you thought it was. They never said the assessment was wrong. By doing so, they acquiesced to the value they set in the assessment, even if the appraisal might also have some value.
Perhaps the assessment wasn't wrong in the year it was done. I mean, the problem is no one knows when it was done. So how does a judge determine that that was actually the mark? I mean, I hear what you're saying. The assessed value is supposed to be the same as market value. That's the goal, and that's where we start. But when we get to a situation where you could have assessed value that's 5 years old or 4 years old, how do we know that any longer equates with market value?
And the district court gave the defendants the opportunity to make exactly those arguments
but
and to come forward with that evidence.
Your argument presumes that the district court was accepting the assessed value as the market value in 2012, and the fact that the district court didn't use it indicates the district court wasn't satisfied that that tax assessed value was in fact the market value in 2012.
In that case, Your Honor, that's completely contrary to the record. All we have in the record was that as of 2012, this was the assessed value. The plaintiffs or the defendants never submitted anything into the record to say, hey, this assessment was actually done on such and such a date. This assessment, the land value has changed since then. They had the opportunity to do that. They had a specific invitation to do that. They didn't. It wouldn't be fair for this.
21 in the, I think these are the factual findings. The court accepts plaintiff's assertions as to 2012-2013 assessed values of the property. However, notes that the assessed values are not equivalent to market values and that only values relating to 2012 are relevant. So the district court didn't feel it had sufficient evidence as to the value in 2012.
It was tentatively accepting that, subject to a specific invitation to the defendants to offer contrary evidence, an invitation which they declined to act upon. So at that point, the acceptance of the assertion is the only evidence in the record as to what the assessed value is. Furthermore, this goes back to my next point, which is the market value versus assessed value. And it's notable that even the Green Acres Statute, 273.111, I'm getting the right one this time, subdivision 5 requires the assessor to make a separate market value assessment under the Green Acres program. In other words, even the Green Acres Statute that the respondents are relying upon here says that the assessed value is the market value. Furthermore, the question of whether the primary use of the property was agricultural, the respondents want to say, hey, the assessor said it's so, so it's so. The assessor doesn't get to make that determination here. Under MUFTA, the district court makes the determination, and the evidence in the record does not support that there is that the primary use of the property was agricultural. $4,000 plus some feed for hobby horses doesn't meet the standard here. Lastly, the idea that the assessment value relied on by the court was a minimum of $1.9 million. Yes, that the court could have relied upon that as the minimum value, but it gives no reasoning on why it goes to the minimum value and doesn't find for something higher. And for all those reasons, we'd ask that this court reverse the district court's holding and reject the primary appeal. Thank you.
Thank you for the arguments and briefing. The case is submitted.